Hi, this is John Slip with Speedway Soccer. I'm here with Jonathan Slate, who's co-hosting with me today. And I'm really excited about our guest today, Laurent Dubois. I tried to pronounce it. I've asked you before, and I'll let him correct it if I said anything wrong. Professor Dubois is a professor of Romance Studies and History at Duke University. Of his many books, including one on the banjo, I found that really interesting. In 2018, he released The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. Professor, first off, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Okay, so I'm going to start off. I was telling you this beforehand, and I've written you before. I taught a course this semester at Vanderbilt University in the spring on soccer. You teach a course on soccer at Duke. Yep. And I'm assuming the book, from what you say, covers some of the same ground you do in class, or at least plays off of that. And I think, first off, this makes the students really, really fortunate because it's such a wonderful book. You organize it around different player positions in soccer, goalkeepers, forwards, et cetera, as well as to people outside of the pitch, fans, referees, managers. You draw upon all types of narratives, pulling it together. But before we go in, Slate and I have a number of questions to ask you about the book. But I'd like to hear about your experiences teaching about soccer to Duke students. Hear a little bit about their reaction to it and how this informs how you think about soccer.
You know, it's been a fabulous experience. I've taught this class since 2009, and like a lot of classes, I guess, you know, I first proposed it as kind of like a specialty, you know, upper level class. I got a ton of students signed up, and so it pretty quickly evolved into kind of a class I teach regularly, a big lecture class with sections. We now actually teach it with multiple languages, which is particularly cool. So there's sections, sort of students can take, there's an English language lecture, but then students can do their reading and discussion in Spanish, French. We've had Italian, German, and Portuguese as well. So that kind of gives that's neat too, because it sort of becomes a, you know, more multilingual. And there is, you know, for your listeners, there's a blog called Soccer Politics, which is the name of the class, that has basically all of the writing and that the students do. It goes up on that blog, goes, you know, it's meant to be, you know, reaching outside the university. And that's really fun too. Their projects are there. And so, you know, it's been tremendous because the students bring all kinds of perspectives, you know, from some who are deep, deep, deep into soccer, you know, whether they grew up in the U.S. or in other parts of the world, and others who are kind of just curious or coming to it. So it's really interesting how many different angles people have on the sport, and I've learned a ton from them. And it's true that writing this book was partly the result of teaching that class and thinking through, you know, what is it that how do we just deepen our sense of this kind of art form, if you want to think of it that way, or this form that is so remarkable, tells us so much about kind of human society and history. So it's a really fun venue to students to explore that. And it's, you know, we can weave between talking about the last week's Premier League games and what happened to these really philosophical questions that come up around the sport. And I also, obviously, it intersects the course. A lot of the course is about how this the game intersects with big themes in history, you know, whether colonialism in Africa and dictatorships in Latin America, and questions about race, questions about gender, all those sorts of things. So you really can tackle, I think, lots of big questions through teaching the sport. And that's one of the things I love about it too.
So this isn't a question that we had sent over to you kind of beforehand, but, you know, kind of talking about how soccer and everything intersects with life, but just kind of, have you taken notice, like in the past, you know, couple months with, you know, with everything with the COVID-19 pandemic, and then also with the Black Lives Matter movement within, you know, what's taking place in the Premier League, is that something that surprises you, or, you know, as, you know, how entwined soccer and politics are, doesn't surprise you?
You know, for me, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I first got into writing about soccer, writing about the French national team. So first book that I wrote, called Soccer Empire, is really about the intertwining of politics and sport in France, and the way in which that French national team essentially became a kind of center stage for debates about racism and immigration in France, starting in the 1990s. And one of the characters, the sort of main characters of that book, is Lilian Thuram, who is a French soccer player and activist, very active, has always been very politicized, who actually came to Duke the first year I taught the class in 2009. I brought him here, and I've since, you know, I know him pretty well. I've translated his book into English, and So my access to the world of athletes has been through someone who was particularly active. I often tell the story that when he came to Duke in 2009, Michael Jordan, one of the things he did with his money was his like car dealerships in this area, you know, like because we live in North Carolina. And so Lilian Thuram saw that I had a car from like Michael Jordan Nissan. And he was like, he sort of said like, is that what Michael Jordan did? Like with all his, you know, his prominence, you know, that's what he did with it kind of. And it was sort of interesting because in 2009, it's true that he was looking at American athletes and kind of wondering like, what are you guys, you know, why aren't you guys more active? Why aren't you active the way that some of us are in Europe? And, you know, now, I mean, as we talk about, he's almost like, well, now you all are sort of the leaders for this. And in some ways, like the European athletes are kind of following the lead of Kaepernick and others. So it's really interesting how much that's shifted. And notably how much college athletes are involved in politics now. You know, so we're really living in a very different world, and there's interesting things to think about. But in some ways, you know, there's always been intersections, and sometimes it's explicitly like athletes being political and taking political stance. But I just argue in the class that in some ways there's also just there's like something deeply political about soccer always, because it's about people's identities and how they, you know, how they identify themselves, how communities work. Who's on the team, of course, becomes kind of a whole question about larger questions. So I think it's just shot through with politics because, and some of that's just because, as I keep emphasizing in the book, like soccer is also about stories. Like it keeps producing these narratives that are also about community and identity and who we are. And so questions about race and gender are always coming in. So yeah, it's just kind of, to me, it's, I mean, I guess I wouldn't have predicted the way things have gone in the United States, but in some ways it seems to me almost like it makes sense, you know, that these things are integrated. And what I feel like is it's sort of interesting how much people have finally kind of come around to seeing how clear that is, you know. And if you had told me that NASCAR, you know, the things that have happened in NASCAR in the past month would have happened, I wouldn't have believed you, you know. But it's, you know, that's what history is. It's always surprising, right? We don't know what's coming.
So when I was writing up questions to ask you about, I ended up bookending the beginning and end of the book because I think they're just both beautiful moments. So I want to go to the beginning of the book, your definition of soccer. And this probably ties in a little bit to the answer you just gave to Slake's question. But you begin the book with the question, which is a great place. What is soccer? And then you provide sort of a staid description of it as game. But then you just start hitting with us with a lot of provocative, poetic generative lines like soccer is possibility. The ball is unnecessary in the end, you say, because soccer more than anything else is an ideal. Soccer is life. Soccer is human. Soccer is sanctuary, right? So let's just, let me hit that question. How is soccer a possibility? How is it an idea? What do you mean when you say it's life?
Yeah. It's interesting because one reviewer of the book, a guy named John Swainsburg, pointed out, he said, you know, in some ways, this is what they used to call like a commonplace book, which is like a book of like engagement and quotations with other people's writings, you know? And it's true that a lot of what I did when I wrote this book was just, I immersed myself in all of the writing that there is about soccer. And there's so much incredible work that's been done, you know, writing that's been done. And so that riff at the beginning was a little bit like, you know, many of those are kind of inspired by different people's takes on it. It's just that what I was trying to get at was that this, you know, this basic thing, right, that I think those of us interested in soccer are always saying to people, and people, you know, people kind of know, but don't necessarily integrate, which is, okay, here we have like maybe one of the cultural forms, if not the cultural form that's most widely shared across human beings, right? Which is astounding if you think about it, because it's sort of a strange game. It's got, you know, it's got these kind of particularities that, you know, people who hate soccer always point out. But the idea that this has become so universally shared, you know, I just, that kind of raises the stakes on how you analyze it, right? Because you have to say, okay, so what is it about this thing? And the form of the thing obviously is doing, it has to be doing many different things for it to be that, that important to so many people, right? And the ways that the emotion that this game generates are just off the charts, right? A kind of extraordinary for a skeptic might just say like, I don't understand why people care about this, right? It's just a game after all. But so I think the challenge for me was to sort of somehow capture that in the opening, which is to say, okay, yeah, of course it's just a game, but it has all these other things. And I think, you know, again and again, part of it has to do with the fact that it's, it's a form of story that kind of unfolds as you're playing it. And, you know, I say that a couple times, right? Like every game is a story, whether it's like the pickup game that, you know, someone's going to play next week, or Liverpool just winning, you know, the Premier League championship, or, you know, these are stories that are integrated with other stories. And so I guess that was what I was trying to get across. And I, you know, it was partly the introduction, I hope, is meant to sort of show people what the book is about, you know, and this is not a book about like soccer tactics, although those come in. It is sort of a more philosophical, you know, almost kind of like literary read of the game. So I partly wanted, you know, to some extent, for that to be clear from the beginning, so people could decide whether they wanted to keep reading. So I think, I mean, it was partly I had a great editor, and that was sort of, one of it was his idea, was sort of to say, you know, rather than an introduction, which was sort of like a little bit more academic, let's say, you know, sort of like soccer, I argue in this book, you know, it was to kind of lay out that argument and to put down a bunch of the different things, and also to open up for people, because I sometimes do that in class, you know, I sort of like, okay, like what's soccer, you know, like what, or what, at least what are the metaphors, or what are the kind of things you can correlate it to? And so to use that a little bit. And of course, ideally people will realize that, you know, they can have their own answer, you know, that's not, I don't have I don't have the one set of answers, but there's all these different ways you can answer the question. And hopefully keep asking yourself that question. And I mean, because what I want to do with the book is also for people who love the game, or who are just learning to love the game, to sort of ask themselves, well, yeah, what is it about this that is so interesting? Because I do think that just makes it even more interesting.
Wait.
It's definitely something that, you know, I enjoyed kind of hearing that from that philosophical standpoint. And so one of the things you talk about also in the introduction is that the game, about the game growing in the U.S. And, you know, one of your early claims is in the United States, soccer is a way of feeling connected to so many places at once, and offers different ways of imagining ourselves within the world. Can you kind of talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, and this comes out of, you know, there's always a lot of, you know, there's a kind of a sort of pathos of the American soccer fan, you know, like this kind of perpetual sort of like, why is, you know, there's a, you know, because you're part of this world, like this kind of world, although obviously this is even changing now, but certainly when I was growing up, you know, there was this sort of sense of like soccer is a little bit marginal and kind of European, you know, I come from like a European family, so we sort of were interested in it, but I always felt like it was out of a little bit, didn't have its home here, you know. And I mean, I often cite the Galeano, Eduardo Galeano line, you know, it's like soccer is, in America, soccer is the sport of the future and always will be, you know, kind of that idea. But I also, what I realized over time, and my students have helped me see this too as well, is that, I mean, first of all, it's a hugely popular sport here. I mean, as I argue in the beginning, I think it's probably the sport that's played the most in this country, actually, as, you know, with all the informal play, and also because women's and girls' soccer is so huge. But that basically the things, so, and it's also has to do with the fact that people, I think we have to think carefully as American soccer fans, like, what do we want soccer to be in this country? And I'm not sure that, for me anyway, I'm not sure that what I want it to be is the same as, you know, the NFL or the NBA, right? I think that what draws people to soccer in this country is, in a sense, its global dimension. The fact that, you know, it's not going to be for any time soon anyway, a sport that the Americans are like the best at, right? Or it's a sport instead that connects us, right, to all kinds of parts of the world. And since, you know, of course, we're a nation with a lot of shaped by immigration and a nation connected to other places, but also a nation where there's often been, you know, versions of American exceptionalism or more parochial ideas. So I do think that, you know, there's that and what I know from seeing my students is that I think a lot of students, you know, they like the fact that they're connected to England or Germany or Brazil through this sport. It's part of who they are. It allows them to have an identity that has this connection. And it allows them to travel and make connections with people, around this. And they understand that and they see that in their own lives. And so I think, that's, you know, that's part of it. And I think the interesting question is, you know, has to do with also then how soccer fandom in this country works and the MLS and the NWSL and how that kind of moves in. You know, every NWSL or MLS game, you know, has all these flags of other countries like around, right? People bring flags of the players who are playing, and that's a really interesting phenomenon, and I think, you know, has meaning. So one of my favorite tournaments is always the Gold Cup tournaments in the United States, which are just phenomenal and, you know, bring out all of the different nation. So it's, I think all of that is just a really interesting part. And I'm trying to invite people in the book to, you know, fans to really think through, well, what, you know, what is soccer to them and what do they want it to be? And, you know, are the institutions that currently represent soccer actually representing that? Or, you know, those are also, I mean, they're questions about politics, like within, like about the structures of soccer that I think, you know, I'm trying to get people to think through as they're reading.
Okay, so moving into another chapter and talking about the goalkeeper position, you pull up a quotation sort of to set this, and thinkers and eccentrics gravitate to the position.
Yeah.
The goalie must learn to be particularly philosophical, leaving out a kind of symposia on the turf. So are there people you have in mind that you think embody this quotation? And talk a little bit about how you see goalkeepers in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so part of the funny thing is that I was goalie, you know, as a kid, like on my YMCA thing. And it was fun to write about that a little bit. You know, there's a number of places in the book, actually, where I write autobiographically, which is, again, something I don't do that much, and I haven't done that much in other books earlier. But not that I was thinking, I certainly wasn't a very good goalie, but so that was part of it. But it was also true that, I wrote, some of this book came out of writing for different magazines around the World Cup. So I wrote on the beginning, there's a series at the New Republic, in 2014 for the 2014 World Cup. And I wrote, my first piece was called a prayer for the goalies and the referees of the Gold Cup, you know, and of the World Cup. And I basically was sort of saying, like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in the World Cup, but I know that goalies and referees are going to suffer. You know, they're going to experience traumatic things. There will be sort of a goalie that during this tournament, you know, lets in a goal and no one will ever forget it, you know, and a referee that makes a call that everyone will talk about for decades, you know. And I think that, but I think the goalie at the same time is like the pivotal position in soccer in a certain way. Kind of embodies so much of the contradictions and the tragedies. I was heartened to find, as I started reading, you know, things like Albert Camus, that which I knew about, who had been a goalie, but then what I didn't know about when I started writing the book was Nabokov, who had, you know, written about it, about the ways, even someone like Buffon, you know, Gianluigi Buffon, who writes this kind of interesting philosophical letter to his goal. So I think, you know, those just kind of pulled together. And I thought, you know, and some of it's just natural because you're kind of away from the game. You're different from other players. You have this kind of strange relationship to the turf, to the space. It's been really fun. I started coaching a girls' youth team in Durham. And in that process, it's been really fun, like training goalies and sort of seeing how you can bring this to bear on like what it means to be a goalie. I thought those would be funny and interesting ways of also just sort of bringing in the kind of intellectual and the literary and the story. You know, it's particularly the case that the goalie has just, I think, produced these kinds of reflections. That was one of the early chapters that I wrote, and I was sort of developed the voice for the book by writing about that.
Yeah, I really loved also the quote that you used from Jonathan Wilson too, about the goalkeeper being the destroyer of harvest, the bringer of famines.
Yeah,
it was just something that I really like. But kind of sticking with, you know, talking about the goalkeeper. But one of the things in the book that I really liked is like you talk about and give antidotes from not just men's soccer, which I feel, you know, probably a lot of people are very familiar with, but also in the women's game as well. Mm-hmm. And you talk about a story between Hope Solo accepting the blame when a time Brandi Chastain had actually been the one that made the mistake, and it was seen as the polite move from Solo, mm-hmm. and kind of a sign that she wasn't ready to lead her defense. What did you find interesting about that narrative?
Yeah, I found that was, and I actually, yeah, reading Hope Solo's book was, you know, I was obviously trying to just read memoirs of players and, you know, so I was looking for things written by goalies. I mean, I would say that, you know, one of the big intentionalities of this book is that it's sort of, I don't know if it's exactly half and half, but like the women's game is there in every chapter. It's part of each story. Just because I was struck, I've been working with a lot of colleagues, some of the colleagues who have who work on women's soccer, and just sort of struck. And as I was teaching, realizing that, like, you know, there are a lot of books about soccer that never mention women, right? And of course, in our country, that's I don't know, just feels like not tenable anymore. So that was, it was an explicit goal of mine to sort of make that, to sort of do that. And I think that, you know, people kind of notice that. And in the United States, maybe it seems a little more logical. In other countries, sometimes people are like, why are you talking about this so much? But so to me, I mean, I've been a giant fan of the U.S. women's team, followed these games. Some of those games are really one of the ones that have marked me the most, and especially in those the tournaments when Hope Solo was playing, and I saw her play, you know, live a couple of times. So anyway, but I loved that anecdote because, you know, some of it is the goalie has to have a personality, right? The goalie, and this was partly because, like, there's a series of French goalies from Fabien Barthez to, like, Hugo Lloris, who are, like, kind of small guys, you know? They're relatively small in size, I mean, but have these giant personalities. And so that just to me, that anecdote where essentially it was like she was supposed to be in charge, right? If you're the goalie, you have to be in charge of the defense. And if a defender messes up, they need to know from you that they did something wrong. That kind of sense that the goalie is almost like this psychological, you know, center, at least for the defensive part of the team, I think is super interesting. And that just sort of crystallized for it. And obviously, I mean, I liked, and this is true using, I used Carly Lloyd's memoir and other player memoirs, but, you know, obviously they, you know, the players at the top level, you know, are the ones who know the best in some ways what it is to be on the pitch. So as much as I could, I tried to pull in the writings that they had and the perspectives they had as well. So I think it sort of crystallizes. It's also just kind of funny because, you know, the personalities of both Hope Solo and Brandi Chastain are kind of well known. And to me, when I read that, I just thought, oh, this is so, so interesting and hilarious that this moment happened, you know, so.
I, in fact, had a difficult time picturing Hope Solo doing the polite move. That was,
She obviously took seriously the advice. You know, she was told to come back and never do that again. And so, yeah. And I do find we have a bit of a hypocritical relationship to our athletes sometimes, you know, which is partly that we want them to be total badasses on the field, you know, be like relentless against the other team and do whatever, you know, tackle them and all this stuff. And then there's an expectation that in the rest of their life, they should be very, you know, kind of sort of, I don't know, live these kind of moral, ethical lives that some, you know what I mean? It's just kind of, it's true that I know, you know, people have very, Hope Solo is a polarizing figure and justifiably for many reasons. But so I was interested in figures like that who, you know, who Maradona also and elsewhere, but sort of figures like that who become these kind of lightning rods, because I do think it's sort of interesting to ask ourselves, well, why do we, what is it that we really want from our athletes? And why do we have sometimes such contradictory senses about who they should be?
So I'm going to shift to sort of, I just want to hear your thoughts on this. This is not an academic question so much as a soccer fan question. In the chapter on the defender, you go through the ongoing battle between those who prefer the game as beautiful and those who think it should be effective or pragmatic. That's all that matters, right? Mm-hmm. Winning is what matters. So if it's an ugly game, that's fine. And I'm interested in your take on this, mainly because, you know, I've been having this argument with people for years and somehow stupidly thinking, you know, we were inventing this argument. It was sort of interesting when Burning the Pyramid first came out. You see Jonathan Wilson quoting that this argument has gone on as long as soccer itself has gone on, of course. So where do you stand on it?
Yeah, and it probably comes through, I think, through the book. But I'm definitely on the kind of like beauty. Probably beauty is more important than, or it's not necessarily only beauty. But I guess what I'm trying to emphasize in the book is that, like, the significance of play, like the way that play is and what it does for us as a kind of form, is the most important thing about soccer, you know? So that in a given, it's not the outcome of a given game that matters so much as the bigger story, you know, because the wonderful thing about soccer is there's always going to be another game, you know, like they're going to keep coming, you know, you don't have to worry that this is the last time you're going to see a soccer game, right? So, in some ways, I think, and I think the real question is the bigger picture, right? And so I really like the idea. I mean, I think also that, you know, if you're, I mean, the debates that we all have had in the United States, right, from people who don't like the game, right, and who kind of, part of it is I've always had these debates with people, and it's, my point has always been like, you know, the things that people who don't like soccer don't like about soccer are the very things that make it, I think, so popular in so many places, notably the low scoring nature of it, right? So the the fact that there's so few goals is precisely what makes it powerful, I think. And that is precisely something that means that in the end, if you don't, I mean, if what you're watching the game for is just the goals, you're just not going to get that much out of it in many cases. I mean, occasionally you will if there's, you know, certain games, but if you're not there watching for the beautiful moments or the beautiful plays, if that's not part of what you're doing, then it's, I can see why you wouldn't necessarily enjoy the game, you know? So I do think it's like, you know, that the kind of interest in beauty is part of what, you know, what just makes it possible and interesting, right? You know, so, and I also just like, I mean, partly because I'm, you know, that I've, as like any fan, I've suffered through innumerable losses of teams that I've been rooting for. And, sure. You know, if you don't have something, like, if you can at least remember, like, yeah, but there was that amazing play, you know, then you're just, then it's just depressing, right? So I think, I do think that for me, I'm on that side of like, and it's one of the reasons why, yeah, I know you had mentioned like the debate about VAR and those sorts of things, but I do think to me, it's almost like, I mean, and Galliano is, you know, who's obviously very important to me, is a, kind of talks about being just like a beggar for good soccer, right? Like in the end of the day, what I want is to be moved. I want to be like amazed. I want to be surprised, you know? And, you know, I can, if a game delivers that, then the particular outcome that ends up delivering that to me is maybe a little less important than the bigger gift that it's given, you know? Which is not to say that I'm not super depressed when, you know, when a team that I'm rooting for loses, but I do think it's like that bigger picture is what matters.
Yeah. Yeah, we have that argument fairly often, even just among us on the podcast, between those two, you know, aspects. You know, so in the chapter on Fords, you give us a great deal of history and politics, you know, ranging from everything from the history of the women's game to politics of immigration. But in the end, you kind of turn to Nick Hornby's discussion of the thrill of watching when someone score when it happens, because it happens so rarely. And, you know, a Ford ultimately is the person who reminds us how to turn a possibility of a goal, of a victory, of happiness into reality. And I feel that both myself and John, you know, love this notion. And a lot of it fits, kind of fits the our reality. But how shared do you think this is across soccer or football fans?
I mean, I think on some core level, it's I was trying to get at that kind of core thing, which is like, if you are lucky enough to watch, you know, a goal be scored and, you know, the unfolding of that when you, you know, especially because, you know, when you watch a game, like you think a goal is going to be scored, you know, probably like 100 more times than it actually is scored, right? You know what I'm saying? Like there's so much like cases where you're like, okay, I think that's, so it's just that ability to turn the kind of the latent possibility that's always there into the actual reality and the endlessly different ways that takes shape. I think that's the fascinating thing, right? All the different ways that goals are scored, right? Some of them just random, some of them just beautifully done, you know, and even a given player, like if you go through just different Messi goals, it's not like after five Messi goals, you're like, oh, okay, that's that kind of goal. You know what I mean? Like almost every single one is like a new, almost like a new invention or something. So I think to me, that was what I was trying to get at. And it's true that, of course, that's the moment when it all finally kind of comes together. And also, I mean, at the same time, how often, you know, it's sort of accidental or unusual or those sorts of things, I think is also, you know, in the French case, this path in 2018, right, in the French men's team, like the Pavard goal, you know, or like Umtiti's goal, or these players that you would never expect. I guess, you know, that I think is also interesting. But I was fascinated. And that was, you know, again, the goalie part and the defender part really were a little easier for me to get into, even the midfielder. But I don't feel like I'm a forward in the way that I play, but it was like, it was sort of like the least familiar, just psychologically that. I was trying to figure out how to kind of describe that, and get into that mindset. There's less writing by forwards, you know, there's a kind of different, it's a sort of different group of people in certain ways. I think, I don't know if that's not quite a fair thing to say, but you know, it's like a psychologically slightly different than some of the other positions. And, so that was kind of my attempt, but also to just explain how obviously, so it's obviously central. So and finding the right people to, you know, there are so many other examples I could have used, but in each case I had to make these decisions about, well, who's going to be the example. So in that case, you know, deciding that Maradona was going to be an example helped me, you know, because I think I could, the Maradona case, I think is helpful in terms of thinking about the kind of madness of a forwarding. So,
definitely. I'm someone who also, you know, would not call themselves a forward, like, and but it's probably something most people want to emulate as a whole. It's definitely, right, you know, trying to understand how these people think when they, right, you know, you think of this, the forward as like the position that is most like highly exalted and, right, people lifted up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And makes sense. You know, and so I think it, even if, as in the other chapters, I was partly sort of saying like, oh, actually these other positions are maybe more important in a way or sort of more fundamental, but it's obviously true that what I was trying in each chapter is to explain what's fundamental about each position, you know, that they all obviously are vital. And so, yeah, so that was my attempt to kind of capture that. And I mean, that Hornby book, I think there's so much, he captures so much in that book. You know, it was one of the ones that I really enjoyed kind of thinking about how to incorporate. So,
there are several passages from your book that I have utilized in all types of conversations and discussions, from tweeting them out, to putting them on Facebook, to reading them to friends to get reactions. And one of my absolute favorites, and this is drawing back to something you said a couple of minutes ago about VAR, is about the referee. And I'm going to read this. It's not super long, but I'm going to read the quotation because it's been very useful to me. You say, "In truth, however, we, being soccer fans, love the feeling of being wronged by the referee. It's one of the most powerful and cherished emotions that a soccer fan can have. One of the uncomfortable but fundamental truths about soccer is this. The fact that it is so often unfair is one of the reasons it is so endlessly absorbing. Without the all-powerful and endlessly fallible referee, we would have so much less to watch and talk about." Now, I agree with you totally on this. And, you know, I have friends, this leads into arguments about how much VAR we want, how much technical refereeing we want to get involved in the game. We obviously can't have in soccer, there's too many contingencies to have the sort of robo calls and balls and strikes like baseball's trying to do. But where do you stand on how much VAR we should have, how technical refereeing will change the game and our experience of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So I started out super anti-VAR. I actually even wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal before the 2018 World Cup that was like, no, thank you. You know, I don't want this. And I was very pleased because like Andres Cantor, the guy, the kind of a caller on Univision, like agreed with me, which I felt like that was like the highest point of my achievement. But at the same time, I've been I've been curious to see how it unfolds. And what I guess I would say is, you know, my biggest concern was, of course, that there was a way in which, there's some people doing work outside. Are you hearing that on the?
No, I'm not keeping up at all.
Okay, cool. We have some painters outside in there. So, let me start again. So my biggest thing was that I think that I was concerned that VAR would bring in a kind of set of elements of, you know, that it would take away some of the drama and precisely these elements that I'm describing, where to some extent the unfairness, the moral complexity of the game would be pulled away. And so my experience of what's happened since VAR is basically, I would say, like, I'm actually reassured at how robust soccer is in its irrationality, because I think that to some extent, occasionally a VAR call is like, yeah, a good thing they were, you know, occasionally that happens, you'd be like, oh yeah, okay, that's totally clear. But very, very often, and I think significantly more often, it just creates more debate. You know, I actually like, it just multiplies the extent to which people argue about calls and whether, why was VAR used then and it wasn't used this and exactly. So it's interesting that it certainly hasn't resolved the kind of, I don't think it's made soccer fans overwhelmingly feel like the game is like far fairer now. I think it's actually just sort of multiplied the points about which they can argue about refereeing calls, you know, so sort of, and the other thing that I think, the other big worry I had was that I was like, I was really worried about the fact that I was like, look, if VAR removes goal, like there is a way in which right now when a goal is scored, you're not sure that it's going to count, right?
Yep. Every time.
You can't celebrate, you know, you always have to stop. And so my more optimistic version is I'm like, well, it's hopefully, you know, what I've noticed is in the best of worlds, it actually offers two goal celebrations now instead of just one. So you have like the initial goal celebration, and then you all stop, and then you like have another, another celebration afterwards, you know. So hopefully, you know, that'll continue to happen. I do think that there's a worry, a good worry about the kind of creeping technologism, you know, ends up like moving, you know, that you, there's always that worry, right? They're going to be like, cause there is a way in which how are you going to decide where to stop? Right. Cause you could basically VAR like everything in soccer and go back, you know, 10 minutes if you wanted to, right. And sort of say, well, if that hadn't happened, right. You know, because everything is connected, I think. So that's kind of the biggest concern. So, but I don't know, you know, I mean, I'd be curious to hear what you think about it. But that's my take. I mean, I think it's an ongoing thing. I do think there's enough. There's definitely, it seems to me, a core desire to not have the flow of soccer interrupted. I do, my experience of, so my first experience of being in a live tournament with VAR was the Women's World Cup, where it was really disastrous and terrible. You know, like, so I was at the Jamaica-Italy game when the goalies, you know, stopped a goal and then VAR took away, you know, a series of calls I just thought were terrible, you know. And it's incredibly demoralizing and weird when you're in a stadium because you also can't see anything. You can't see what, you know, the people who are watching the VAR. So I find that experience gave me left a really bad taste, you know, for me. But, you know, I think, I'm going to be interested to see the ongoing debates. One of my pleasing moments when I was teaching, I remember once when like an American student was like, after a whole discussion was like, you know, I always thought he basically was like, I have a lot of friends from other countries who hate the idea of VAR and are against it. And as an American, I just could not understand them. And now I think I get it, you know, like now I get, because for so many Americans, it's almost like obviously you want technology that, you know, making sports more fair. It's like so ingrained that it's kind of, it takes a little work to get people to understand, at least to understand the opposing position. So.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, okay, I was just like,
yours. Take it.
No, what for me is, I feel like the VAR, like I definitely want to see calls get right, but also it's the, you know, the romantic aspect of, you know, you can just play the sport with a ball and even like four shirts laid on the ground, and it's still similar to, you know, what the professionals are playing.
Yeah.
And I feel like you lose that a lot of the similarities at the grassroots levels versus, mm-hmm. you know, what's being at the highest echelons of the sport.
Yeah. So I just, I think I'm on board with both of you. I'm going to say something similar, but I was at first totally against VAR. I've become comfortable with it. The only thing I'm not comfortable with is when it breaks up the flow of the game too long. My feeling is that VAR should only overturn decisions when it's very, very clear. And if it takes very long to look at it, you have to keep looking at it over and over, it's not very clear. If we could somehow institute a rule where there's, you know, you've got to make the decision in 30 seconds or something like that, I would be much happier. Yeah. Because I do get driven crazy when we keep going slow motion to try to figure it out from different angles. So
yeah.
I'm okay with a bad call sometimes.
Yeah. And the easy, like pithy answer is, of course, I'm like for VAR when it helps my team and I'm against it when it goes against my team. I also do. I mean, as you can see in that chapter on the referees is partly like a defense of referees, you know, like partly I guess, I mean, but sort of like, hey, you know, you're not going to have this game without referees, right? You know, like you, and I do think that, you know, actually referees have long done remarkably well with obviously glaring exceptions, but, you know, they generally do very well, I think, you know, even without the VAR. So I do think it's also, it seems to me that like the English Premier League has leaned a lot towards like retaining the authority of the referee on the pitch and sort of, you know, only overturning like really, really clear or kind of enabling them to check on things. Cause otherwise I do think that's a problem too. If it becomes, you know, this kind of surveillance body, you know, in the thing. And because I do think that the referee, you know, or absolutely not. I definitely do. I mean, the big fear, of course, of all soccer fans is moving to this kind of like basketball or football sort of style game where it's like stopping constantly, you know.
That's a huge concern. Yeah. So listen, we really appreciate the time you've taken today. I want to I'm gonna go with one more. Really, this is not even a question so much as a reading, because I like it so much. Like I told you, I was gonna close out with the bookends of your the book itself. So I'm gonna read this quotation and just have you tell me a little bit about what you were trying to get with this, because it's really, again, like I told you, that the I found the book very beautiful. So did my students. Your last chapter is about the fan, their experience of the game, and I just want to read the final paragraph. Because I love it aesthetically, but because I'd also like to hear you say, this is how I ended the book, and here's what I wanted the reader to take from it. So here goes. You say, soccer is yours, so take it. Make of it what you will. A symbol, a mirror, a story. Watch it. Talk about it endlessly. Speak it, this precious human language. Hold on to the delight it offers, for joy is a universal right. Play it. Find something, anything, a rock, a bicycle, a coconut, and make a goal. Put the ball down on grass, dirt, asphalt, sand, and then begin with a dribble, a pass, a kick. Everything lies ahead. So respond to yourself on this.
Well, first, thank you so much for your words about it. It really just means a huge amount that you're appreciating it, because it's, you put these things out there and you're not always sure whether they're going to land or... I guess it's, I wanted to try to pull together all the different strands in the book, but concretize them a little bit, like by the choice of the objects, right? Sort of just pointing out like all the different places you might play, the way that I did at the beginning. But also to sort of this kind of sense that this is a thing that's everyone's, that anyone can use, can deploy, can have. Just in a world where there's so much inequality, where there's so many borders, where there's all these sorts of things that we obviously experience every day, to kind of put forward that idea, even that line, that kind of like joy is a universal right, right? Like obviously that, I don't know if people put those together that often, but this kind of idea that, there is a kind of right to be able to have this game and to have it sort of be meaningful in all these places. And that the game itself sort of is also the how widespread the game is I think an assertion of people's, something shared across all of humanity to desire to have a space of play and communication through play and those sorts of things. So I kind of just wanted to try to capture that sense of the power as much as I could. And also, for the book from the beginning and at the end, it's meant to be an invitation for people to, it's definitely not meant to be like everything that one could say or, the definitive this or that, right? It's really, the book is meant to be written as a kind of invitation for people to write their own stories about soccer, to think about it in whatever ways, to take this, and go with it. So I think, that was partly true. I just wanted to kind of like emphasize that spirit of the work. That there's, cause it just feels like there's obviously so many different ways that this was my way through it. But that there's lots of other ways, obviously, one could take it. So, to leave that opening for people too. Finally, it's just a sort of, I've written many books, many of them about very tragic and depressing things. And this, I'm a historian actually, like slavery in the Caribbean and all these things. So this book, and there's things I think, that are hard or difficult in the book, but the idea was to write something that, left people feeling like, okay, ready to play basically, and to kind of communicate through it, and to take the some of the, hopefully the philosophical and political aspects of the book, but also take that into their own lives. So.
All right. Well, listen, we've taken a lot of your time today. We really appreciate it. I want to remind everyone, this is Laurent Dubois. The book is The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. If you are a soccer fan, and you wouldn't be a soccer fan, if you're listening to this, you have to be a soccer fan. So I would rush out and get this book, get a copy of it. Slate, do you have anything finally you'd like to say?
No, I just want to say thank you for taking the time, to talk with us about your book. It's something that, it's a book that I really, really enjoyed getting into, and because Sloop had recommended it, but it was something that I very enjoyed, and so thank you again for taking your time today.
Well, thank you both so much. It's been great to meet you this way over the air. I hope maybe we'll meet up in Nashville sometime, and hope that, thanks for doing the show and having me on it today. It's great to be here.
All right, thanks.
never go full shepherd. Nope.